thing. Fine reached into her pocket, and her fingers closed around her phone. She slid it out, but kept it behind her back. Blum noted this, but Atkins didn't. She was staring at the floor, lost in her own self-pity. Blum rose and moved so she was in front of Pine, blocking Atkins's view of her. Pine quickly flicked through her screens and tapped on a couple of images. Blum said, "But unlike Joe, you were probably able to get her to talk. To reveal things she didn't want to reveal because you were smarter than she was." Atkins looked up with a desolate expression. "Joe never gave me credit for anything. I was the one who told him to go into the security business when he lost his job. I helped him get started, and then got him clients. And I was the one who told him we needed to put that girl in a cage. I knew she was nuts. The man that took her, Wanda said he told her Becky's parents wanted to kill her, and they probably had good reason. I came to see that. He saved Becky from whatever she was involved in, but he did us no favors, that's for damn sure."
"It must have been really intrusive for you."
"At first, I thought it might be okay, you know, having a kid. You're right. I did want children, but I had a problem there and couldn't. But I wasn't sure this was the right way."
"But you still took her in. That was good of you."
"At first, Joe thought it was so great. See, he was the one who really wanted her. A frilly little daughter to dote on. But 6 months after she came into our lives, it was like I didn't exist. All Joe saw was cute little Becky," she added in a derisive tone. "He totally ignored me. And then she grew up. That cute little puppy turned into a wolf, a monster."
"That all must have been difficult to accept," said Blum in a supportive tone.
Atkins exclaimed, "It was impossible. Who was this stranger? What right did she have to come into our lives and take my husband away from me? What right? Oh, she was so cute, so pretty. And I was what, a lump of coal?"
"Yes, I see that."
"Well, Joe didn't. Made me so mad I wanted to kill him and her."
"But you talked to Mercy. You learned things about her?"
Atkins smiled slyly at Pine. "I knew that was her name. She told me it was. But then I spent years wiping that out of her memory, out of her life."
"How did you do that?"
asked Blum, keeping her gaze on Atkins.
"It must have been difficult."
"I had my ways," said Atkins with a wicked grin. She mimicked a little girl's voice again. "Don't, Mommy. Don't do that. Don't burn me. Don't cut me." "Your name is Becky, I would say. Becky. Only Becky. Mercy is dead. Do you understand? Mercy is dead. Over and over and over. It finally got through. Finally. No more Mercy." She smiled. "See, I won. I beat the little brat. She thought she was so smart. Well, I was smarter."
"Did you have to make her forget anything else?" asked Blum.
Atkins's features calmed, and she looked down again. "There was one thing I could never make her forget," she said.
Pine tensed and said, "What was that?"
"Eeny, meeny, miny, mo." She glanced up at Pine. "Stupid nursery rhyme. She read it in a book we had. She went ballistic. She tore the book apart. She was screaming. Joe had to come in and hold her down. And she was only 7 or 8 at the time. I had no idea what the hell that was about. Crazy, stupid kid. Worst mistake of my life taking her in." Blum glanced at Pine, who had closed her eyes and looked away. Blum turned back to Atkins.
"So the night Mercy escaped?"
"Idiot Joe forgot to lock the damn door. Before we knew it, here she comes, running past the house. Joe had seen it on his TV screen. He went after her, but the moron didn't take the gun.
I remembered it, though. I went after her with it. Because you couldn't let her get away. Of course not. We'd go to prison if she did. But I don't understand. If you had the gun, why didn't you stop her? Joe grabbed her, but she slugged him, and he fell and hit his head on a rock. Blood was everywhere. He tried to get up, but I think he had a concussion. He fell back to the ground and didn't move. Mercy saw the blood and him lying there not moving, and she ran like a damn racehorse. I don't think her feet touched the dirt. What happened next? I fired twice at her, both barrels, but she was already into the trees. I was going to go after her and finish her off, but then Joe came too, got up and tried to stop me. He tried to take the gun away. Why? Said Blum. He must have known what would happen if Mercy got away. He was soft, Atkins said in a disgusted tone. He didn't want to kill her. He wanted to let her get away instead, if you can believe that. Said enough was enough, the idiot. That must have upset you. She smiled maliciously. So I told him, look, Joe, there she is. She's coming back. When he turned, I picked up the stone and hit him in the head. Knocked him cold. I wanted to shoot him, but the shotgun was empty. So I ran into the house, got a knife, and finished the job, said Blum. When it was done, I wiped my prints off the knife and called Wanda. I told her Becky had killed Joe, and then I grabbed my stuff and they helped me disappear. Pine swallowed nervously and asked in a tentative voice, and Mercy got away? She was alive?
Yes, the bitch damn well did.
Pine gripped the bedpost hard, her eyes shut, her heart soaring with hope. Atkins suddenly looked alarmed, as though she had just come out of a trance. She stared at them stonily.
But I'll deny everything I just said, and you can't prove otherwise.
Oh, I think we can, said Pine, opening her eyes. She held up her phone and then hit the play button on the recorder function. Atkins's voice came through loud and clear. Realization of what had just happened spread over Atkins's features, and then her face hardened.
You can't do that. You tricked me. It's illegal.
Pine shook her head. Technically, I'm not the arresting officer. You've been read your rights, including the right to remain silent. If you choose to spill your guts, that's up to you. And you haven't engaged counsel yet, nor stated that you wanted one. This wasn't an interrogation. You just spoke of your own free will. And I just happened to have my recorder on.
I'll get that thrown out, you bitch.
Well, you can try, Pine said. I'm sure the Georgia police will be in touch, particularly since you made their job of convicting you so much easier. Pine stepped forward and leaned down so she was eye to eye with Atkins. And just keep in mind that Mercy took the best you had and still kicked your ass. And she's out there somewhere free and living her life. And you're going to spend the rest of your sorry life in a place a lot worse than this. And I wish you many, many more years of living. Pine called the jailer, and she and Blum left. As they were walking down the corridor, Pine said, "Great job on getting her to open up." Blum unexpectedly sighed.
"I still wish you could have kicked her butt."
Pine put her arm around her friend's shoulders. "Oh, we did better than that. Way better." Chapter 34. Kane pulled her car up to the curb and looked over the modest rancher in a working-class neighborhood outside of Huntsville, Alabama. It was a place where Kane could have grown up, playing with dolls and riding bikes and kicking soccer balls in the backyard, having barbecues and running under the sprinkler in the summer, roasting marshmallows and building snowmen in the winter, although she doubted it snowed all that much this far south. Normal. She snorted at the thought. Right. That was some fantasy. She had blown out a tire in a remote area halfway through her drive from Georgia. Kane had no spare, and it had taken well into the night to first find a tire shop, and then for the shop to get a replacement tire, since her car was so old. After that, she had driven until she was exhausted. She finally spent the night in her car just outside of Huntsville, before waking up, having a hot cup of pretty bad coffee, and finishing her journey. And now here she was. The air was warm, the sun shining, the birds were swooping around, and Kane felt like she was on the way to attend her own funeral. She headed to the front door. She knocked and waited as footsteps approached. She wasn't sure how she was going to handle this, but maybe that was a good thing. Ever since her escape from the Atkinses, she'd been winging things for the most part. Sometimes it had worked, and sometimes it hadn't. But why change now? Wanda Atkins opened the door with an e-cigarette in one hand. She stared up at the towering Kane, and her free hand flew to her mouth, almost dislodging the cannula in her nose as she recognized her visitor.
Oh my God. It's you.
It's been a long time, Wanda. And even with the lack of hair and the years piled on, I guess I haven't changed so much. Wanda started to shake.
I'm so sorry for everything, Becky.
It's Elle now, short for Eloise. Wanda looked startled for a moment, and then a sad smile eased across her face.
Eloise, like the book I brought you?
Yeah, only it was Eloise at the Nightmare House. My own little fantasy, added Kane. She looked at the cannula in Wanda's nose and the attached oxygen line. You sick?
Smoke too many cigarettes.
She held up the e-cig.
Now a vape.
She eyed the tall Kane warily.
What are you doing here, Eloise?
Can I come in? Wanda looked uncertain about that, so Kane just stepped past her and into the house, and there was nothing she could do about it, which made Kane feel immeasurably powerful. Wanda followed her into the living room, where Len Atkins was asleep in his wheelchair. There were stacks of folded laundry on tables and chairs, and some dirty dishes piled on an ottoman. The mingled smells were fuggy. To Kane, they smacked of old and sick.
Sorry for the mess, Atkins said in an embarrassed tone.
Kane shrugged. This is a lot better than where I used to live, right? The walls aren't dirt, and when you want to open the door, it opens, right? Atkins coughed and glanced nervously at her husband.
I guess you remember Lynn. He had a stroke a while back.
Whatever, said Kane brusquely. She didn't care about strokes or Len's or Wanda's problems. This moment was all about her. Wanda quickly moved some of the items off the couch so Kane could sit. She sat across from her in a chair and studied the younger woman.
Why did you cut your hair off? It was so beautiful.
Not after my time with Desiree, it wasn't, Kane replied, tacking on a grim look at Wanda. She had fun pulling it out by the roots or setting it on fire.
But then you know all about that.
The older woman shrank back under her fierce gaze, like a flower getting hit by a sudden burst of frost.
I think about you a lot, she said lamely.
You did some nice things for me, Wanda.
But I never did anything about.
No, you never did, said Kane in a harsh voice. But then she shrugged. It wasn't your problem, right? And in the end, I took care of it myself.
Joe deserved whatever you did to him.
I knocked Joe down when he tried to stop me, and he hit his head on a rock. If he died, it wasn't my fault. Then I just ran for it. Somebody fired a gun at me and missed. Had to have been Desiree because Joe was already dead. Then I just ran harder. I kept going for miles and miles until I was able to hitch a ride. Wanda looked at her with a startled expression. What? Asked Kane. Wanda composed herself and said slowly,
Joe didn't die because he hit his head on a rock.
Well, then what happened to him? said a now startled Kane.
Joe died because someone stuck a knife in his back. He was deliberately murdered.
A knife? Said Kane, now visibly stunned.
There's no doubt. It punctured his heart.
Kane sat back, and it was like a great weight had been lifted off her. Then I didn't kill him. So why is the FBI after me?
I didn't stab him, but I bet you know who did. I always thought it. I mean, Desiree was so
evil?
Yeah, she was.
Do you know where Desiree is now?
I have a phone number, but no address.
Atkins looked nervously at her.
And you don't want to go down that road, Eloise. It would not be good. You have to stay away from the past. I don't want you to be hurt, not again.
I was hurt a lot, while you stood by and did jack shit. I'm still hurting, actually. She rolled up her sleeve so Atkins could see the knife etchings, the lumps and the burns that would be with her till she died. You think this shit ever stops hurting? Not to mention how she messed with my head. That was even worse than this crap. Wanda's eyes filled with tears, and she put a hand to her mouth to stifle a sob. You can cry, Wanda, all you want. It won't change anything. It won't change how I feel about you or old Lynn in the wheelchair over there. You got to live your life. You got to walk in and out your door whenever you wanted. But not me. You ever think about that when you went home and left me where I was?
Are you here to hurt us?
Wanda looked over Kane's large, muscled physique, her eyes swelling with the fear that physical harm was imminent. Fortunately for you, no. But I know that the FBI is looking for me.
They were here.
Kane looked alarmed.
Here?
When? How did they find out where you were?
She didn't say.
She?
A younger gal around your age, and an older woman. They were asking questions.
Kane thought about what Kyle, the teenager in the woods, had said about the tall FBI agent. What sorts of questions?
About what happened that night. They said they had a video of you.
Yeah, I saw that on the TV. What exactly did they ask about?
About you. How you got to where you did. What happened on the night you got away. But they also told me some things.
Like what? Asked Kane.
That your real name was Mercy. And that a man kidnapped you from your house.
Mercy?
I was kidnapped, said Kane. Yes, a man named Ito Vincenzo. He and Lynn were in Vietnam together. He told us that your parents wanted you dead and that he, well, that he rescued you. But according to the FBI gal, he was lying. He took you from your parents for his own reasons. It had something to do with a grudge he had against your mother. The mob was involved or something or other. It was truly bizarre.
Wanda paused and said,
And he left the other child. He apparently did a little nursery rhyme to pick which one of you to take. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. How sick is that?
Chapter 35. Kane felt her heart start to pound, and an intense pain shot through her head along with a cascade of repressed but still ill-formed memories. It was like her brain was moving so fast, it was burning itself out, all safety valves blown right through. She glanced at Lynn.
Am I having a stroke?
She now remembered going berserk when she had read that nursery rhyme in a book while she'd been with Desiree. She had come upon those words, and it was like something exploded in her head. She had never known why. But the other child? Then she felt stupid. The rhyme was a choosing rhyme. Of course there had to be someone else. And then something else clicked in her mind. The rare memory she had always carried with her that allowed her to survive Desiree.
It's okay, Mama. It's just Lee being Lee.
She'll find her way down. She always does. Don't be mad at her, Mama.
Eloise, are you okay?
Cain came out of her musings with a jolt and stared at the old woman, but her heart was racing like she'd just snorted a dozen lines of coke. Something just occurred to me, that's all. So my real name is Mercy?
Yes. Do you remember that at all?
Cain shook her head. Desiree did a really good job of making me forget things. She looked darkly at Wanda. But then you knew that too, didn't you? Wanda quickly looked away.
I guess you hate me.
And you have every right.
I don't think you're important enough anymore for me to hate, Wanda. Wanda glanced up.
What have you been doing all these years?
Surviving. She glanced at Len. Will he always be like that?
Yes, and it's just me to take care of him, really.
Well, I guess you both are living in your own little prison now, aren't you? Tell me, how does it feel?
I'm very, very sorry, Eloise.
Yeah, you already said that. But then words don't cost anybody anything, do they? What else did this FBI lady say? Why do they want to find me if I didn't kill Joe?
I think they want to help you. You were kidnapped, after all. And I looked that up after they left. The FBI deals with kidnappings.
All these years later.
It's a cold case. That's what they call it on TV. Maybe you should go and see them.
Cain eyed her closely, her suspicions running high. She wasn't ready to believe any of this, particularly coming from this woman. Are you sure they don't want to arrest me for Joe's murder?
Well, I don't think so.
You don't think so? That's not good enough.
I don't know any more than that.
Which means I'm still screwed. The weight of the world seemed to reappear on Kane's broad shoulders. What about Desiree?
What about her?
Give me the phone number. I want to call her.
But why?
I don't think you have any right to ask that. Just give me the damn number. Cain rose and looked down at the woman. Wanda stared back up, obviously frightened. It's good to be scared, Wanda, when you're around me. I'm not normal. No one would be normal after what happened to me.
Give me the number.
Now! Or I won't be responsible for what I do to you or the prick in the wheelchair.
Are you going to try to find Desiree?
And hurt her?
That's my business. You don't have a say in that. Not now, not ever. Wanda rose, slipped an address book out of a drawer on a side table and tore out a page.
Here, just take it. I never want to talk to that woman again.
Cain took the paper. Does Desiree know about the FBI visiting you? Wanda nodded.
I called her.
Why? To warn her?
Something like that.
Blood really is thicker than water.
Desiree is not a blood relative of mine, said Wanda petulantly.
Really? Well, pardon me for being confused on that shit.
Can you forgive us?
Asked Wanda. Cain shook her head. The only reason I'm not going to hurt you both is because you're not worth the trouble. She held up the paper. But if this number is not Desiree's, then I'm coming back. And everything that bitch did to me, I'm going to do to you. And I haven't forgotten a single thing. Trust me. After she left, Wanda collapsed back into her chair, sobbing. On the way to her car, Cain stopped and launched a powerful sidekick against the lamppost next to the sidewalk, sending it crashing to the ground. Then she climbed into her car and looked down at the paper with the number on it. She had never been this close to Desiree before, and she knew she had to keep out of the range of the FBI. But now that she had made the decision to do this, there was no turning back. If she was going down, so was Desiree. Chapter 36. Cain had no intention of calling Desiree. She drove into Huntsville and stopped for something to eat. She also searched on her phone for a way to find the address attached to the number Wanda had given her. She quickly found it, and for a small fee to allow herself premium status, the internet search service she had found spit out the name Dolores Venuti and a physical address in Asheville, North Carolina. Dolores Venuti must be her new name. Kane plugged the address into her phone GPS. It was 5 hours if she didn't stop. It was mostly interstate, and the hours went by fast as she drove through the Blue Ridge Mountains. The peak fall colors had passed, and many trees had dropped their leaves, but it was still an inspiring sight, if Kane hadn't been so oblivious to her surroundings. She listened to the radio for any additional mention of Becky from Georgia, but there was none. About an hour out, she stopped once to pee at a rest stop, then sat outside at a picnic table and drank down a bottle of G2 and ate a banana she'd bought. She stretched out some kinks in her back and legs before she got back into the car. Before she drove off, she opened the glove box and eyed the Glock in there. She'd had the gun for 3 years. She'd only fired it at shooting ranges. She pondered whether she could actually fire a round into Desiree's head. She came away unsure. But that was progress. Only Kane didn't know what kind. The woman had tortured her for all those years, piling one despicable act on top of another. And Joe had done little to stop her, so she had no reason to feel any sorrow at his death. Yet she had been relieved to know that she hadn't killed the man, after all these years of thinking she had. But the fact that his true killer and her years-long torturer, Desiree, had gotten away scot-free was just too much to take. What she was doing might cost her whatever life she had left, but she also knew she could never enjoy another second of living while Desiree breathed air. All those years ago, Kane had simply wanted to get away. Now she wanted something more. You could call it payback, revenge, justice even. She wasn't sure which one was applicable, if any. But she was sure that whatever it actually was, she had to get it or die trying. It was like all the emotional bills pending from that time in her life were now coming due, and she was the debt collector. Within another hour, she pulled into Asheville. The address was a shop, one of those weird-ass occult shops, observed Kane, as she drove past and saw the sign. Figures. And there was a police van parked in front of Desiree's place. The front door of the occult shop opened, and two people dressed in blue scrubs and booties came out, carrying what looked to be trash bags, while a police officer stood guard at the front door, his fingers curled around his gun belt. The scrubs opened the rear doors of the van and put the bags in the back. She pulled down the road and parked a block away. Then she got out and walked back toward the shop. A woman came out of another storefront about 4 doors down. She was in her 50s, heavy set and with gray hair tied back in a bun. She had on jeans and a long green apron with the name Organic Alley stenciled on the front. It matched the sign over her shop. Kane walked up to her and said, "What's going on there?" She indicated the occult shop. The woman looked up at her.
"Dolores Venuti was arrested. At least that's what I heard."
"Dolores? Really?"
"Yes. She owns that shop."
"What was she arrested for?"
"I walked over there earlier and asked some questions. They really wouldn't tell me anything, but I hung around and I heard some of the policemen talking."
"What did they say?"
"And who are you and what's your interest?" said the woman, her look now suspicious.
"I'll tell you. I drove all the way up here from Alabama because Dolores offered me a job in her shop. I've done occult retail before. I'm sort of into it." The woman looked over her appearance and said,
"Yeah, I guess I can see that."
"So I quit my job and came here. And now it looks like I'm SOL. So that's my interest." The woman clucked in sympathy.
"Oh, you poor thing. But it might turn out to be a good thing for you because I heard the police say they found drugs in her shop. You don't want to be caught up in all that. And they mentioned something about a young girl that Dolores had done something to. I even heard the word kidnapping. I mean, you think you know people. But she always gave me the creeps, to tell you the truth. And between you and me, she struck me as being a little bit mean.
Wow, who knew? Said Kane with feigned surprise, which was maybe the most complex bit of acting she'd ever attempted. So I guess Dolores is in jail?
Yes, the detention center on Davidson Street. It's not that far from here.
Well, hopefully they keep her behind bars, right?
Oh my God, yes.
Kane turned and walked back to her car and sat in it. She looked up the detention center address on her phone, drove there, and stared up at the place. This was the closest Kane had been to the woman in a long, long time. She felt chills all over her body. She can't hurt you anymore, Elle. Elle? Apparently my real name is Mercy. That's what Wanda said the FBI had told her. And I suppose they wouldn't lie about that. She sat back against her seat and closed her eyes. Mercy. She said the word out loud. It was a strange name. Why would her mother have named her Mercy? And the other child, the one on the other side of the nursery rhyme? Kane scrunched up her brow, as though that would make her damaged memory suddenly light up and tell her all. It didn't. Nothing came out. Except for one thing.
It's okay, Mama. It's just Lee being Lee. She'll find her way down. She always does. Don't be mad at her, Mama.
Was Lee my sister? Was she up a tree and I was telling our mother not to be mad? The weight on her chest was suddenly crushing. It felt like when she had overdosed the first time. She was panicking. She felt she couldn't breathe. She got out of the car and proceeded to run. She ran faster and faster down the street, turned right, then left, and reached what looked to be a small park. Kane plunged directly into the thicket of trees and ran until she could run no more. She stopped at one massive oak, wrapped her arms around it as though to prevent herself from lifting off the ground, and slowly slid to the dirt. She lay there for she didn't know how long. Kane wept so hard, it got to the point where she could form no more tears. Her chest stopped heaving, and she was able to stand by gripping the tree trunk and hoisting herself a few inches at a time, like she was climbing a slick pole. She composed herself and walked unsteadily back to her car. She almost couldn't find it, but when she climbed in and shut the door, she felt a bit better. She hadn't been this way in years. After escaping from the Atkinses, every fourth or fifth night of freedom would end in night terrors. She would awake, certain that Desiree was right on top of her, ready to drag her back to hell. She drove off, found a hotel, and checked in. The place was more than she could really afford, but right now she wasn't thinking about that. Later, Kane had a drink in the bar and some dinner at a restaurant a short walk down the street, because she just needed some brisk air to chew on. After that, she walked back to the hotel and wondered what she was going to do now. Desiree was in jail. There was no way to get to her. And even if she did, what was she going to do? Kill the woman with her bare hands? Scream at her? Torture her like she had tortured Kane? And then what? I go back into another prison for the rest of my life? Has all this been for nothing? Chapter 37. For the 20th time, Buckley studied the frozen image on his computer screen. His first viewing had filled him with curiosity and even sympathy. The woman, who he now knew had been called Rebecca Atkins, was obviously scared. He could easily see that in her features. The wild eyes, the unnatural stretch of her jaw, the bulge of her cheeks, the chaotic gap in her mouth, all spoke of crisis. But there was also just the tiniest hint of something else there, too. Exhilaration, perhaps? Her physical state was deplorable. The long, thick hair was bushy and filthy. The clothes were near rags. Her skin was dirty and scarred. Clearly, the woman had been through a long ordeal. Next, Buckley had researched online an incident related to the Atkinses in the early 2000s in a rural Georgia county. It had not been hard to find the account of Joe Atkins having been found dead, and his wife Desiree missing and either presumed to have killed her husband or else been a victim of his murderer. He reclined in the desk chair in his hotel room. There was an extremely curious point to all this. These news accounts had made no mention of a Rebecca Atkins. The most obvious reason for this would be that the authorities were not aware, back then, of the woman's existence. So how could that possibly have come about? Buckley once more looked at the woman's image on his computer screen. Back then, there had been no ubiquitous wireless home surveillance camera technology tied to smartphones. So why have a security camera in rural Georgia nearly 20 years ago? Buckley enlarged the image and studied the edges of the picture. A tree branch. The murky outline of a bush. A darkened path. All of this was behind the woman who was staring at the lens. She was in the woods, which in rural Georgia was not unexpected. He enlarged the image even more, and now could see the wall of the place. It looked dilapidated, with vegetation growing around it. Not a traditional residence. A cabin in the woods, maybe. But with a camera covering the door? What would be the point unless something of value was kept in there? His first thought was maybe some sort of illegal operation. Maybe they were running moonshine, or smuggling drugs, or selling guns, or perhaps people, like this woman. Were the Atkinses running a human trafficking operation? That didn't seem likely to him. Most times such operators quickly moved their merchandise by truck to locations all over the country. They got their full compensation when the product was delivered. This woman looked like she had been a prisoner for a long time. Unless she had been delivered to the Atkinses as a slave. He looked down at his phone screen, where an associate had previously sent him a copy of Eloise Kane's current driver's license. The face that stared out at him seemed carved from granite. There was nothing happy about the features. The long dark hair swirled around her shoulders. The photo, not particularly good to begin with, and even grainier as a digital copy, was some years old. He sipped his drink and made a phone call. Buckley told the man what he wanted done. 2 hours later, through a text, Buckley received copies of the Georgia driver's licenses for both Joe and Desiree Atkins. Buckley checked the physical descriptions. He was most concerned with height. Joe Atkins was 5'5". Desiree was 4'11". He looked at Kane's driver's license. Her height was listed as 6'1". And in the image he had seen of her on the TV, she looked every inch of it. Unless a serious genetic aberration had occurred, or there was some ancestor of considerable height lurking in the family tree, Rebecca was probably not the Atkinses' biological daughter. Height was one of the most predictable genetic traits passed from generation to generation. Short parents typically made for short offspring. The same for tall parents. He looked at the images of the Atkinses on their driver's licenses. There were no similarities between their features and Rebecca's. And the hair color, while not decisive, was nowhere close. So either she was adopted, or she'd been abducted and provided to the Atkinses. Unless they had done the abducting. He focused on another aspect of the case. A news article from back then detailing the loss suffered by Leonard and Wanda Atkins, Joe's parents and Desiree's in-laws. Buckley reasoned that they had to know about Rebecca. They lived nearby and were the only family Joe had. And they were the only survivors, other than Desiree, mentioned in the news article and the related obituary. The article also said that Leonard Atkins had fought in Vietnam. Buckley checked Len Atkins's age at the time, which was given in the article, and added on the intervening years. He would be well into his 70s now. He sent an email with another information request. An hour later, he received a reply. It turned out that Atkins was registered with the VA and was getting treatment after having had a stroke. And the reply included his current address. Buckley didn't know how his associate had obtained this info so fast, but he thought that the VA needed to seriously upgrade its cybersecurity firewalls. But then don't we all? However, this time, he wasn't complaining. Buckley was wheels up on his jet in a few hours. When they landed, he drove a waiting rental car to a hotel where he had made a reservation. He checked in, went up to his room, and spread his case files out on the desk. He had some wine from the minibar and pondered what to do next. This was all growing extremely complicated and intriguing. He opened his laptop and brought the image up. He flicked his finger against Rebecca Atkins's / L. Kane's picture on the screen. She would not be easy. He smiled at the challenge. And since the FBI was now involved, he had a unique asset that he could call on to help him in his quest to find the woman. It was late, but he could always leave a message. He hit the name in his contact list, and a voice answered within two rings.
Hello, Peter. I trust you have something worthy of me. I've been rather bored lately.
I do indeed. In fact, it has to do with your former employer.
The Army or the FBI?
The latter,
Buckley replied.
Excellent. I always love to stick it to the Bureau when given the chance.
They're looking for a woman named Rebecca Atkins, a.k.a. Eloise Kane, and so am I.
And your interest in her?
Entirely personal. She killed my brother, Ken,
said Buckley. Sorry to hear that.
I can send the jet. Just give me a location and a time.
I'm a bit tied up at the moment, just finishing something up. I can be ready to go tomorrow morning around 8. I'm in D.C. currently. I can go out to Dulles to catch a ride.
All right. They'll fly out of the signature terminal.
And where are you?
The great state of Alabama.
Okay, and what is there of interest to you in the great state of Alabama?
I'll fill you in when you get here,
promised Buckley. Private jets are so convenient. I wish I could afford one.
Well, you'll always have the use of mine.
Aren't you sweet? Look, I really have to go. A few things to tidy up, like I said.
Right. See you soon, Britt.
He clicked off. Chapter 38. Britt Spector put her phone away and looked down at the body on the floor. A few minutes ago, it was a living, breathing human being. Now, she had transformed it into a corpse via a broken neck that would make it look like the very elderly and long-serving and high-ranking congressman had fallen down the stairs of his lovely home in a stately old neighborhood in northwest D.C. The tox report would show that the man had had too much to drink and was already unsteady on his feet due to some neurological ailments and cognitive debilitation, although he had won his re-election by a landslide. And the forensic trail the fall had left would not suggest foul play, because while she had nudged him down the stairs, it wasn't enough to change the trajectory of his descent, alerting the police that something was amiss. Then it came down to finishing the job with a slight but classic maneuver on the man's already extensively damaged vertebra that the Army had taught her. And he had died. Simple and easy. Spector had no sympathy for the fellow, who was cruel and corrupt. For over 4 decades, he had sold his influence in hundreds of different ways, with wired funds sliding into foreign numbered accounts, or substantial favors and hidden payments handed out to those he favored, relatives, friends, mistresses. Sometimes it was as simple as making sure a law wasn't passed. Indeed, he was known as a particularly efficient bill killer. And the laws he made sure would never see the light of day usually would benefit the masses, who had little money and no power. Thus, the result of his either stonewalling or passing a bill always benefited the wealthy and the connected, because they could reward him. That was how the game was played, and he played it better than most. And his growing net worth had been explained away through well-designed investment devices or lucky business gambles that had nothing to do with luck. His real wealth was outright hidden from view in those numbered accounts in faraway places. However, he had gotten too big for his britches and made a fatal mistake in deciding to renegotiate a deal that was already done for far better terms. Spectre's employer on this job had had this done to them once too often by the man. Before, they had agreed to his demands. This time, they had decided to cut their losses and also take the congressman out of any more deals, as well as the remainder of his years. And with his declining health, it was getting far more difficult to trust and control. And there was growing concern he would let something slip that would spark an investigation that would turn out to be inconvenient. The far younger man replacing him at this pinnacle of power would not be nearly as duplicitous, or stupid enough to think that he could get away with anything. They were all cookie-cutter drones. The only principles they believed in were the ones that benefited them. The question was simple. How much would they cost? They were just another line item in a budget, though that line item would never officially appear in any budget. Yet they made it no less critical. The calculation was a simple one. Laws equaled money. If you made the laws, you made the money. And this immoral and corrupt man, whose political decisions had harmed many ordinary citizens in myriad ways, would be buried, and his loved ones would mourn him, but then they would immediately fight over his money, the only thing of value he would leave behind. Good riddance, thought Spectre. She finished with the body and took her time erasing all traces of her presence there. After that, she made her way out the way she had come in, via an impossibly high window, and down a wall that seemed to have no visible means of support for such a climb or descent other than a copper gutter. But that was for the average intruder, not Brit Spectre. There were no signs of forced entry, and that would make it certain that the police would conclude the man's death was an unfortunate accident. She walked down the darkened street and arrived back at her hotel in short order. She took a shower, had a drink, and sent an encrypted message to her employer. Then she waited and checked an electronic bank account to make sure that the remainder of the agreed-upon funds had been deposited. When this was verified, she went to bed. She rose at 6 the next morning, showered and dressed, packed her bag, checked out, and was on her way to Dulles via an Uber. She liked working for Peter Buckley. He was a class act who paid extremely well, and he never called her in for something that was not aligned with her elite abilities. Spectre caught the Uber driver checking her out in the mirror. Spectre knew she stood out. 5'10", lean and willowy, she had driven herself hard most of her life to achieve her goals. Her features were exotic due to her Filipino father and Scandinavian mother. Her skin was olive and her hair blonde. Her father had been an Olympic-caliber judo athlete. Her mother had been a tall, rangy biathlete, and she had taught her daughter how to both ski and shoot at the same time. Her parents' athleticism had passed to their daughter, though she had not followed their paths in life. She had other goals. She looked at the man's hungry gaze in the mirror. Any woman would easily be able to read that look. "You like what you see?" she said. He nodded.
"Very much."
"Well, life is full of disappointment," she replied. She turned away and thought no more of him. Yes, men were easy. Women were hard. And apparently Peter had found a challenge for her to take on. This was exactly what rocked Brit Spectre's world. Chapter 39. The wheels of the Bombardier jet solidly gripped the tarmac and held as it landed at the Business Aviation Park. The aircraft taxied to a stop, the door stairs dropped down, and off stepped the sole passenger. Spectre carried her black leather duffel over one shoulder, with a confident swagger in every stride. Before joining the Bureau, she had completed college and then enlisted in the Army, jumping out of perfectly good airplanes with the 101st Airborne Division. Before every mission, they would smear any exposed part of their skin with multicolor camo paint. It was a difficult process, and you had to get it just right, or the entire purpose would be defeated. Irregular diagonal lines across the face, two colors on the lips, nose, chin, etc. Don't forget the ears, neck, eyelids, hands. Done right, even if the enemy hit you with a light, you would still be invisible. you could kill them before they killed you. Done wrong, you were a sitting duck with a Hollywood premiere-grade spotlight shining on your soon-to-be-dead ass. Yet the army had never understood or appreciated her. When the promotions didn't come as fast as she would have liked, and after some of her extracurricular activities had drawn the ire of those in command, she'd gotten her honorable discharge and moved on. She'd then taken her talents to the FBI. She'd stayed there long enough to realize it was also not a good fit for her personal goals. So she had become a freelancer, in a field she had very much made her own. In doing so, she was deploying the same skills she had gained and burnished first in the military and then at the Bureau, but making far more money in the process. And best of all, it was a life of her own making. While her parents had been exemplary athletes, they had truly been disasters as parents and at providing for their only child. Thus, Spectre had grown up poor and physically and verbally abused by a mother and father who had never achieved their dreams of athletic glory and had taken that failure out on her. After escaping their yoke, she had worked for all she had and never wanted to be poor or abused again. She climbed into the passenger seat of the waiting black SUV, and as soon as her butt hit the leather, they were off. Driving was Peter Buckley, immaculate in pearl gray slacks, a classic navy blazer, collared shirt, and pocket square. He turned to her and said,
"Good flight?"
"Beats the hell out of a jump seat on a C-130 wondering whether a Sam was going to blow you out of the sky."
"Your work in D.C. went well?"
"As well as possible, thanks."
"But now you're on my clock,"
he said.
"Same terms as before?"
"Double."
She slid her sunglasses down to peer at him. "I sometimes forget what an attractive man you are, Peter, dear. But why double?"
"Because this job, I think, will be worth it."
"You mean doubly hard?"
"You live for the challenge, or did I remember wrong?"
She slid her shades back up and looked out the window. "You never do anything wrong, Peter, do you?" He handed her an iPad.
"On the drive, read the file I've put together. We'll eat in my hotel suite. I've already booked you a room. You still like champagne with your niçoise salad?"
"Is there any other way to have it?" As the SUV drove along, Spectre read the file once, then twice, and then a third time, which she had been trained was where the truly useful knowledge and nuance was gained. "Who's the FBI agent on the case?"
"That I don't know."
"Shouldn't be hard to find out. I still have contacts there."
"Even after what happened?"
She looked up from the iPad. "Nothing officially did happen, and I don't burn bridges. At least not with people who matter."
"Okay, see what you can find out, but leave no fingerprints."
Spectre smiled to herself, perhaps thinking about her last assignment. "I never do, Peter. Now that I've read the file, tell me what you think." He went through his theories about the woman named Rebecca Atkins being a prisoner in Georgia. When he showed her Atkins's image, Spectre scrutinized the screen and nodded. "Wooded area, the terrible state of her, surveillance camera. That would be my conclusion. So now she's calling herself L. Kane."
"And she killed my brother Ken, as I told you."
"I never met Ken, but I'm sure he was tough."
"He was. But with someone who knew what they were doing, like you, he wouldn't be much of a match. One man I talked to said Kane tore through a professional fighter with a ferocity he'd never seen before. And she pulled a gun on this same man, and he said she would have blown his head off without a second thought."
"Tell me, why did she kill Ken?"
"Does it matter?"
"Just trying to get the full flavor. But if you'd rather not answer..."
"My brother was with a woman, Rosa. He was beating her. This woman, let's call her L. Kane for consistency, intervened. She gave him multiple opportunities to walk away, but he grew increasingly incensed. When he pulled a gun on her, well, she took it to another level."
Buckley glanced at her.
"Does that make a difference?"
"No. But would it be impertinent for me to say that your brother got what he deserved?"
"It would not be."
"So why are you doing this, then?"
If you had grown up in my family, you might understand.
I might. And then again, I might not. What's the next move?
Find El Kane.
She touched the iPad screen. And we talked to Leonard and Wanda Atkins, currently residents of Huntsville, Alabama, which explains why we're here. Do you think the agent on the case has been by to talk to them?
I would be stunned if they haven't.
And if the Atkinses won't cooperate?
I have ways of making them do so. I'm talking money, of course. And if my methods don't work, I'm sure you can think of some.
You appear to be all in on this. Otherwise, I doubt you'd be taking such personal risks by going after her with the FBI already involved. He glanced over at Spectre, frowning.
I've taken personal risks my whole life, Britt, just as you have. You do so when the stakes are worth it.
Well, you like a challenge, too. Maybe you've been stagnating. Buckley nodded, looking thoughtful.
There's no maybe about it. I have been. The earlier years were the best, when I was building something. Even when I had nothing, there was a dream in place. I guess there was nowhere to go but up, and it all depended on me. Now I go to board meetings or sit in on video conferences. I listen to stupid, boring people say stupid, boring things, and I wonder why I'm even bothering. They make their money, and I make my money. But one can only make so much money.
Spoken like someone who has far more than he'll ever need.
Then I'll triple your fee. But don't ever think money will replace the thrill of living, Britt.
I never said it would, Peter. That's why I do what I do. Chapter 40. We might be too late, said Spectre, as they walked up the sidewalk to the Atkinses' front door that afternoon. Spectre had checked into her room at the hotel and had her champagne and salad in Buckley's suite. Then Buckley had made numerous phone calls and sent texts and emails. Spectre had gone to the gym to engage in her intense daily workout, which had left her sweaty and breathless. She had showered and changed, and they had then driven over here. Spectre examined the knocked-over lamppost. That looks very recent. They hurried up to the front porch, and Buckley rapped on the door. Wanda Atkins opened it and stared up at them bleary-eyed.
I hope you're not selling something because I'm not buying.
It looks like you need to buy a new lamppost anyway, said Spectre, pointing to the demolished one. Atkins stared at it and her eyes bulged.
Well, damn.
How did it happen?
Asked Buckley.
Excuse me, but who are you folks?
Asked Wanda suspiciously. Buckley said,
We're trying to find a woman named El Kane, but you might know her as Rebecca Atkins.
How do you know anything about all that?
Demanded a stunned Atkins.
May we come in?
Asked Buckley.
No, I don't want any visitors now.
Buckley took out his wallet and pulled out a fistful of cash.
It will be worth your while, Mrs. Atkins. We just have some questions. You are Wanda Atkins, correct?
Yes, I am, and I don't care who knows it. I got nothing to hide. But what do you want with Becky?
This would be much better discussed privately,
said Buckley smoothly.
Well, all right,
said Atkins, staring at the bills clutched in his hand. She led them into the living room. Len was sleeping in his wheelchair.
Mr. Atkins?
Said Buckley.
Yes, he's had a stroke. I don't want to wake him. He can't talk anyway. He just grunts, she said bluntly.
All right,
said Buckley, with a glance at Spectre, who was drilling Atkins with a hard look. They all sat down, and Buckley said,
Have you seen Kane lately? Might she have been the one to knock down your lamppost?
Spectre added. That would have taken a lot of force.
Well, she's a big woman, bigger than you, said Atkins before she caught herself.
So she has been here then,
interjected Buckley.
You mention money, said Atkins.
Buckley placed $2,000 in $100 bills on the coffee table.
And depending on what you can tell us, I'll double that amount.
But what I don't get is why everyone's all so interested in Becky now.
Like who?
Asked Buckley. The FBI has been here. Couple of gals.
Female FBI agents? Said Spectre quickly.
Well, one was, I guess. The other woman was too old. I think the agent said she was an assistant.
Interesting, noted Spectre. That's not usually how the Bureau conducts investigations. What was the agent's name?
She left me her card.
Atkins rose, went into the other room, and came back out with one of the business cards Pine had left her and handed it to Buckley. He looked at the name and then passed it to Spectre.
Did you know this Atlee Pine?
Asked Buckley. No, but there's almost 3,000 female special agents at the Bureau.
Are you with the FBI, too?
Asked Atkins, who was listening closely to this.
No, but I know some of the agents.
Buckley said.
What did you tell Agent Pine?
She already knew a lot, but I filled in some blanks.
When she didn't seem inclined to say any more, Buckley pushed the pile of cash toward her.
And we look forward to you doing the same for us, filling in blanks.
But what's your concern in all this?
We have been tasked with finding Elle Kane. She's wanted in connection with a crime.
What sort of crime?
The worst of all, I'm afraid. Murder.
Murder? Who was killed?
We can't go into that right now, but she is wanted by the police. What we're trying to do is find her and convince her to turn herself in. That way no one gets hurt.
My God, she never mentioned a murder.
I'm sure she wouldn't.
Wait a minute. You're not talking about my son Joe, are you? Because Becky didn't kill him.
No, I'm talking about a murder that just happened recently. Now, we've made inquiries, and we need you to validate our conclusions.
Atkins's face screwed up in confusion.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
That your son and daughter-in-law kept Rebecca prisoner in a cabin in the woods and, from the looks of things, abused her emotionally and physically. She escaped from there. Your son was killed by, perhaps, his wife, and both his wife and Rebecca disappeared, and that you and your husband knew about it, and that you left Georgia after it all happened, and Rebecca is now calling herself Elle Kane.
Atkins said accusingly, You've talked to that Agent Pine, haven't you?
Because that's what she said as well, you mean? Interjected Spectre.
Yes, she seemed to have it all figured out.
How was Kane tortured? Asked Spectre, drawing a sharp glance from Buckley.
I'm not sure, Atkins stammered.
We need the truth, Mrs. Atkins, said Spectre, or it will not turn out well for you. We are working with the authorities on this.
Atkins glanced at her sleeping husband and said, Desiree liked to burn things and stick things with needles and carve things with knives.
By things, you mean Kane? Said Spectre sharply.
Yes. When she was here, Becky, I mean Mercy.
Mercy? Said Spectre sharply.
Yes. Agent Pine told me her real name was Mercy, and she was kidnapped from her parents and brought to us in Crawfordville, Georgia.
And her last name?
Asked Buckley.
She didn't say.
Why would the kidnapper bring the girl to you? Asked Spectre.
He was an old friend of my husband's. They fought in Vietnam together. But he said Mercy's parents wanted her to die.
But I guess that was a lie.
The thing is, we believed him. And since we were too old to take care of a child, my son and Desiree took her.
She shuddered.
Mercy showed me some of the scars from what Desiree did to her.
The mental scars will be far worse, said Spectre, staring the woman down. With another curious glance at his companion, Buckley interjected.
Do you know where Kane is now? Did she say where she was going after she left here?
I gave her Desiree's phone number.
Do you know where Desiree is living?
No, I just had her number.
We're going to need that,
said Buckley. I gave it to Becky. I don't remember it.
Mrs. Atkins, let me remind you, this is a murder investigation. If you obstruct the investigation in any way, you could go to prison.
He glanced at Len Atkins.
And then who would take care of your husband?
Buckley knew that if Atkins looked at this with calm reason, his explanation for their being here would seem ridiculous. He wasn't the police. She needn't tell him anything. And yet most people, particularly in stressful situations, were not even remotely calm or rational. They were, instead, vulnerable. And the power of suggestion went a long way with vulnerable people, as did a pile of cash. But Atkins said,
I don't have it. I gave my only copy to Becky.
I'll give you another $1,000.
She looked agonized by this.
You can give me all the money you have, and I still won't have the number.
Do you at least remember the area code?
She gummed her lips and looked at the ceiling.
My short-term memory is just about shot. Comes with getting old.
All right,
said Buckley, looking frustrated.
Do you think she's going after Desiree? Asked Atkins.
Wouldn't you? Said Spectre.
Atkins kept her gaze on Buckley.
But why would Becky kill anyone?
We're not sure. That's why we want to find her, to ask her. And if she is going after Desiree, we need to stop her. We don't want anyone else to get hurt.
Spectre said, Why didn't you stop them from hurting Becky? Atkins seemed surprised by the question.
What? I didn't know what to do. I was afraid.
How young was she when Rebecca became a prisoner?
6.
So you were too afraid to help a little girl?
Buckley glanced questioningly at Spectre. He didn't seem to understand where his colleague was going with this.
I'm not proud of it, said Atkins.
Is there anything else you can tell us about Kane when she came to visit you? Asked Spectre.
She hated me for what I'd done. She probably wanted to kill me. As big and strong as she is, she could have easily. But she didn't.
What? Said Spectre.
I was surprised that she turned out as
normal as she did, said Spectre.
Yes. She seemed to have herself together okay.
With no help from you.
I did what I could, Atkins said indignantly.
Right.
Yes, well, thank you,
said Buckley hurriedly.
We'll be in touch.
On the way to the SUV, Buckley said,
What the hell was all that about, Britt?
Nothing. She just rubbed me the wrong way is all.
Okay, just don't let it get in the way of what our goal is.
It won't, Peter, but you have to admit it was disturbing.
Life is disturbing, but put it behind you. I need your A game for this.
Chapter 41. Back at the hotel, they walked to their separate rooms. Spectre sat in her bed for a long time staring into space, something she almost never did. Reflection for her was painful, and thus counterproductive. She mixed herself a gin and tonic from the minibar and sipped on it, while she looked out the window at downtown Huntsville. She had killed a number of people during her career, some while in combat in the army. Once, as an FBI agent, when a suspected serial killer they had tracked down pulled a gun and was going to empty it into Spectre's partner, she had shot him dead. Then, in her new career, she ended the lives of others she had no quarrel with, solely for payment. So what right do I have to question Wanda Atkins' ethics or morals? She finished her drink, sat on her bed, and took a photo out of her wallet. It was of her parents. Her father had been short and heavily muscled, but immensely flexible, with superb range of motion. In martial arts, that was key, she knew.
Her mother had been tall and lean. Spectre had taken after her physique-wise. She stared down at their unhappy countenances. They had brutalized their daughter, making her childhood a misery. Her father had drunk himself to death. Her mother had died by her own hand, with a rifle similar to the one she had used to compete with in biathlons. Spectre couldn't say she missed either of them. Constant beatings just did that to a child. Part of her, Spectre's surprisingly frail emotional side, wanted to return to the Atkinses for a little visit and end the lives of both Wanda and her crippled husband. It would be easy. But the professional side of her said that was not possible. She lifted the sleeve on her right arm and stared down at the mark that had been carved into her skin as a 7-year-old by her drunken father while her doped-up mother held her. Elle Kane had apparently put herself back together, at least to a certain extent. I'm not sure I can say the same. Unlike Kane, she had undergone plastic surgery to erase all the other marks inflicted on her. Except for this one. Because it had been the first. And because she wanted it with her always, so that she would never forget. Not that I ever could. She had never met Kane. She would kill her when the time came, because that was how she made her living. But after learning what the woman had gone through, she would take no pleasure in it. In fact, she was starting to regret taking this job at all. Give her a corrupt politician to get rid of, or a cartel chieftain, two of which she had sent to the hereafter, or a dictator from a troubled nation who had killed and robbed his people for decades until she had been sent in to hurry him off to an afterlife by the leader of another country. Her employer had been as bad as the dictator, but that was no concern of hers. But this one was different. Still, she had committed to doing it. Even with that, she could only lie on her bed and stare at the ceiling, wondering about her life decisions and not coming away with a single good answer. In his room, after having some wine and doing some other work, Peter Buckley was staring down at his notes from the interview with Wanda Atkins. It was a setback that they didn't have Desiree's phone number or address, but they would have to work around that. And if they could somehow get to Desiree first and then await Kane's arrival, but she had the woman's phone number and might already be well ahead of them. His smartphone buzzed as a text dropped into his inbox. When he looked at the screen, he couldn't believe his good fortune. A transaction had been made using Eloise Kane's credit card at a hotel in Asheville, North Carolina. He pulled from his file a copy of her driver's license. He had two associates standing by for just this sort of eventuality, with immediate access to his private jet. He gave them the necessary information, then he took a snapshot of Kane's driver's license and sent it to them.
"Fly there now, find her, and take her,"
he said in the message.
"And let me know when you do. I'll arrange for a place for you to bring her and text you the location. I'll be there as soon as I can."
He made a call and had one of his people attempt to charter a private plane from a local provider in Huntsville. Unfortunately, nothing was available, and all commercial flights leaving that day had long layovers. He clicked off and then texted Spectre with the news. He added that they would be driving to Asheville, a little more than 5 hours away, and she should be ready to leave in 10 minutes. He received a single thumbs up in reply. He frowned at the response. He was unsure what was going on with the woman, but he didn't like it. He called another associate and told him to find a private place on the outskirts of Asheville and to do it in the next hour or so. It seemed a difficult task, and it was. But Buckley paid for people to do difficult things all the time, and they either succeeded or they no longer worked for him. He packed his bag and left $20 for the maid. Then he met Spectre in the lobby, and they headed to the rental car. Chapter 42. Hello?
Agent Pine?
Yes, who is this? It was the evening, and Pine was in her hotel room sitting on her bed when the phone had rung.
Special Agent Drew McAllister. I'm out of the WFO,
he added, referring to the Washington field office. What can I do for you?
I've been assigned to the Ito Vincenzo homicide matter.
Pine kicked off her shoes, leaned back against her headboard, and thought back to Jack Lineberry's frantic phone call. And this has become an FBI homicide matter?
Yes, and I'd like to ask you some questions.
Okay, go ahead.
I meant in person. Where are you?
Asheville, North Carolina.
I can be there in the morning.
I'm not really sure what I can tell you. And why isn't this an investigation for the local cops? I understand that police from Virginia and Georgia are already involved.
You know how these things roll. The Bureau has an interest, so I have an interest. Can you give me the address in Asheville?
Pine did so, and then they arranged a time to meet in the morning. She clicked off and tossed her phone down.
Shit, she muttered, and then rubbed her temples because she felt a sudden fire there.
They really were going after Tim Pine in connection with Vincenzo's death. Well, they might actually find Tim and my mom for me, and then send them and Jack to jail. Great. She audibly groaned at this possibility. Pine needed to do something, to burn some energy. The weight room at the hotel didn't have enough iron to challenge her, so she ran out to a shop down the street and bought a one-piece black bathing suit. She returned to her room, put on her jeans and a t-shirt over the swimsuit, and headed to the pool. She dove into the water and swam lap after lap, focusing on her strokes and her breathing, a form of cheap therapy. Exhausted, she finished, pulled herself out of the pool and climbed into the in-deck hot tub situated on the pool deck. She let the hot, jet-propelled water envelop her and thought about what questions Special Agent Drew McAllister would ask her tomorrow, and more critically, what answers she would or could give. She climbed out of the hot tub, went into the changing room, stripped off her bathing suit, dried off, and then changed back into her clothes. As she was leaving the pool area, she glanced through the window of the adjacent space where the workout room was located. There was only one person in there, a tall woman with a buzz cut. Probably in the military, Pine thought. She was outfitted in loose-fitting sweats and was moving all the stacks the universal weight machine had to offer. Pine went back to her room, showered, and changed into another pair of jeans and a fresh sweatshirt. After a room service dinner, she sat in her chair looking out the window and then debated whether to take a walk to further clear her mind. With Desiree in jail, she wasn't sure what direction to head in now, but finding Mercy was still her only priority. A moment later, her phone rang. She snagged it off the nightstand. Yes, she said.
Agent Pine, this is Wanda Atkins. I hope it's not too late for me to call.
No, not at all. Did you remember anything else?
No, but I thought you needed to know that she was here.
Who was there? It couldn't be Desiree, Pine knew.
Beck, I mean, Mercy. She was here. She tracked me down somehow.
A dumbfounded Pine stood there shaking. Mercy was at your house?
Yes.
When? When Atkins told her, Pine barked. And you're just calling me now? Pine felt like her head was about to explode. She could barely breathe.
She was very upset, which made me very upset. I've been crying for what seems like days, but I finally decided I needed to call and let you know what happened.
Pine got her nerves under control and refocused. What did she want?
She wanted to know if I had a way to get in touch with Desiree.
And what did you say?
I had a phone number. I know I should have told you, but I didn't. I'm sorry.
Forget about that. It doesn't matter now. Just tell me, did you give Desiree's number to Mercy?
Yes, I did. But she doesn't go by Mercy. She goes by Eloise now. Elle for short. She didn't tell me her last name. Eloise is from the children's book. That's what she told me. I brought her a copy of it while she was with Joe and Desiree. I did try to help her, you know, she added in a pitiful tone.
When Pine said nothing,
Wanda added. Why would she want the phone number? I really don't think Desiree will talk to